Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Paul Tracy, good afternoon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan.
Paul, for me, and I think for a lot of people, you were the highlight of Sky's excellent Dublin Narcos documentary. So you were addicted to heroin for 35 years. And I should warn people now as well that, look, we're going to talk about drugs and drug taking in a kind of an adult, non-shock horror, matter-of-fact fashion now. So if you're not up for that, maybe turn it down. But Paul, will you describe for me the first time you took heroin?
Yeah, as best I can. The first time I took it, and as I said in Dublin Narcos, I didn't know what the product was. There was I was coming of age at that time. I'd been hitchhiking around Europe with a few friends, and we were away for about 8-9 months. When I came back, I was 18 years of age at the time. When I came back to Dublin, and I lived in the city centre in the Liberties in Dublin 8, when I returned to Dublin, a lot of my friends that hadn't come away were using this thing called gear at the weekend. And this was heroin. And the first time I took it, and I would say the first six or seven times, I didn't actually know it was heroin. I knew of heroin from TV and films and American crime things on television, but I didn't realise that that was this product. And I don't know if that would have mattered, but the first time I took it, I just remember the effect it had on me, how powerful that was, how my mind relaxed and how my whole insides settled and how empowered I felt while the drug was effective in me. And for a couple of days after, because initially, when you take such a powerful drug like heroin, it will have this calming effect on you that might last for a couple of days, at least in the early days of using. So when I took it, it had a profound effect on me. I felt almost like I belonged, probably for the first time.
Yeah, remarkable. You say, I think, in the documentary that you were a person with kind of neurosis and all that kind of thing. That all dissolved away. You came home.
Yes, Brent. You see, and it's with hindsight I came to that conclusion.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have realised at 18 years of age that I had a neurosis or anxiety. I was just what would be considered a hyper young person, you know.
Yeah.
I was active, I was always interested, I was up to divilment, I was always curious to the point of recklessness. And so, but when I took this drug, and when I look back today, and with all the work that I got to do on myself through different therapies and everything that I've been in over the years, I realised that I had an anxiety problem. I had a problem with self-acceptance. But this, you see, it didn't look like a problem back then. All I know is that everything in me got relaxed, calm, and, excuse me, I felt very at ease when I took heroin.
So it's funny, some of the other people who were in it as well, they talk about a want in them, or that a lack.
Sure.
A void, yes. Yeah. Is that it, yeah?
I relate to that very much so, yes. And because after taking heroin for a while, when you try to stop it, that void becomes very apparent when you get clean again. And yeah, it's like you may never have identified it as a void initially, but when you take this heroin, it's filling some part of you that's keeping you at ease, and then you don't have it. There's a very apparent void.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so you and your friends, you think you were among the first people probably in Ireland to take heroin. And it was kind of initially, am I right in thinking, the preserve of kind of students and arty types and that kind of thing, yeah?
Yes. I'd come to know after I was using it a few years that the first people, because I'd met some of older heroin addicts who got addicted in the 70s in England and then returned home when it became available over here.
Okay.
But as far as I know, and to the best of my knowledge, it first showed its head up in UCD across the road there in the Belfield Bar. And it was just the indulgence of a certain select group of students, arty types, because it was seen as something like avant-garde.
kind of bohemian-y kind
yes,
of thing.
Yeah.
Right. And then, so what happens next then? You say Irish people took to it like ducks to water. And in the show, they would kind of say there was Larry Dunn and his family suddenly then started flooding the broader inner city.
Right. That's what they... Yes. In my own opinion, though, I don't know if Larry brought it in. He certainly might have jumped on the bandwagon. But they do. Everyone's out. They always look for a scapegoat and who's bringing it in. It was coming in first through Dunleary, as far as I know, on the B&I boats, the Sea Link boats that would go to England. And it would be brought over by students. And then before it hit and became something you could buy in a Corporation Flats complex, it was just something you could get possibly in the Belfield Bar or in McDade's in town. Certain couple of pubs in town. And it was.
Yeah, and I'm sure McDade's would deny that. We're not suggesting
it. Oh, no, no, no.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they knew nothing if that was going on.
Sure.
So how did it develop for you then in terms of getting a hold on you? Did that happen quite quickly?
Not initially. It became something, when you're young and your body's stronger, there's a different sort of, and I didn't have that, that relationship with the drug, because a relationship develops with this drug. That's another aspect to it. So initially, you could come off it pretty easy. You'd have like if you used for a couple of weeks as a young person, you'd have like a bit of a cold or a shiver for a few days.
Okay.
But once it gets into you, and it took me about 2 years to go till I came to the point where, because I'd only sporadically used maybe weekend to weekend, and 2 years, 3 years down the road, I was in London and I was using excessively over there, and I got arrested. So I was in a cell where I couldn't do anything about it, and I went through horrific withdrawals. That's when I first experienced what the hold this had on me.
Okay. Because I wonder, was part of the reason it didn't initially is because you had other things going on in your life. Like, you were a fairly functional individual. You were kind of a hairdresser,
yes,
in 80s Dublin. Like.
That's right. I was, yeah. And in London. And then I went on to Germany. I worked over there as a hairdresser on film and for photographers, fashion shows, all that high-end hairdressing. And... yeah, I've experienced all aspects of hairdressing, but there was a thing called heroin chic back then in the 80s, and where a lot of models and a lot of models, photographers, anybody working in that arty kind of world were dabbling in heroin. Not everybody, but there were.
Okay, so you could operate in that world with,
yes,
and have it a was, bit of a habit, like,
sure.
Yeah. And so then, at what point does your life become a bit more maybe chaotic then?
Well, heroin, to explain this, it's what this drug does. It numbs you down. And I would say it kills your spirit, in fact. And it locks you off from all the sensory experiences in life. So you can't really feel anything. And it's kind of a sad state of affairs when that's a comfortable position for people.
So your whole humanity is shut down?
Absolutely. Compromised, at least in the beginning. And then... as you go deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole of heroin, it chips away at your very character, your personality, your morale, any moral tendencies you might have. And you become like just a rat trying to survive. And your only goal is this. Like I say, it's a relationship you have with this stuff. And no woman, no children, no family can come between that relationship. It's that intense. When it really gets hold of you,
And when you're in, so when you're in that situation, do you kind of think, I'm the one who's right here, this is the way to live, and everybody, oh, look at all those fools out there living this other life?
Not really. I mean, there's always, yes, that might be your surface thinking, because you're just trying to survive and you're just trying to get your product. But there'll always be that little bit of humanity, even if it's only a spark. And therein lies the conflict, because if it was only that kind of thinking, you would just keep doing what you do. But there's always, at least with me, there was always that conflict. There was something in me. I knew I was damaging myself, my spirit, doing something very, on a deep level, that was very destructive for me. But I was too far gone. I was locked into the obsession mentally when it came to these realizations. But there was always something in me knew it was wrong. Like I used to, a little thing, I used to always bless myself or just do a little cry, even though I'm not very religious. I would bless myself before I'd have a hit in the hopes that I wouldn't overdose. So there was that little bit of conflict. I would say to myself, please God, don't let me die. Boom. And I would bang it into me. So there was something always, I was aware I was doing wrong, but that kind of value goes away. It doesn't become wrong, it's just something I need at this stage. So you will rationalise, and you will rationalise, shift your focus, everything to allow yourself to do what you have to do.
And are there people around you and family and like real friends who are saying to you like, Paul, what the hell are you doing?
All the time, yes. No, all the time. As you were saying there, I was a functioning addict for quite a while. But even that starts to show cracks right up through from my late 20s, you know, and I would make attempts to get clean. I would know it was the right thing to do. I would go through horrific withdrawals, come out the other side, but the obsession would still be in me. The obsession was very strong in me. And that's what I found hard to deal with. And the weller I would get, the better I would feel after completing a detox or a treatment or something, as I'd start to feel better physically, mentally and everything, the obsession became stronger in me to taste this again, to taste this stuff again.
That's powerful stuff, isn't it?
It absolutely is powerful, Brendan, yeah.
When did you find out that you were HIV positive?
Very early into the whole thing. See, as I said, I dabbled for a couple of years before I went full on. And to get away from the dabbling, because I knew I was messing everything up, I went to Germany. I returned to Germany when I was 22. And I started hairdressing. I started doing very well over there. I got into a band, which I'd always wanted to be in, and things were going really well. And a friend visited me. And he came over, he just wanted to spend a little few weeks over there to try and get off heroin. And I seemed to be doing very well at the time. And I said, come over and I'll look after you. And
were you off it?
I was. I'd gone to Germany, I got out of Dublin, I realised everything was gone. I'd had been in London and got locked up over there because I was living in a squat in London when everything fell apart over there. It was when I was 21. Spent my 21st in Feltham youth custody for fraud, and we were claiming the dole, and I was claiming for a non-existent partner and a child and things like that. We were living in a squat. There was a whole bunch of us from Dublin doing
it.
Excuse me. And myself and another guy, we got arrested, we got caught, and we got sentenced to 6 months youth custody over there. So I spent my 21st in prison in England. And When I came out of there, I decided, because of the chaos, I came back to Dublin and I'd started to dabble again. So I decided, right, I better get out of Dublin.
Do a geographical.
It was a bit of an intervention with my parents. We had a big family talk and I said, look, I'd go back to Germany, I'd go alone. Because the first time I went there hitchhiking, I went with a whole group of lads. And although we didn't use heroin there, but when I came back, I did. So I decided I would go alone, break away from everyone and try and get my life together. And I was doing pretty well for about 9 months. So this lad came over, a friend of mine from the Liberties, and he brought a little bit of heroin so he could wean himself off. So I ended up anyway having one or two hits with him, even though I'd been clean for 8-9 months at this stage. And he went back home. He couldn't handle it over there. When he ran out of the gear, he couldn't go through the cold turkey. So he went back home. I was still working away, but that following summer, he told me, called me on the phone, told me he had what at the time was called AIDS. Was no HIV then. It was just AIDS and it was a death
and
sentence.
It was, yeah.
And I was like, God, but I probably have it too. We used together at Christmas. And he was like, no, I think I got it after that. I think I got it when I went back to London. He said, I'm sure you're okay. So I told myself that over again to kind of just, so I wouldn't be too worried about it. But some point later that year, I made a test. I was in hospital on an unrelated thing, on a sprained wrist, and they were giving everybody tests at the time. So I made a test, and it was positive. a week later, I went back, you know, to get this strap off my arm for this sprained wrist, and the doctor called me into a room and told me that I had AIDS. And then he started to explain to me what that meant and everything. I just interrupted him and asked, how long have I got to live? And he said, well, if you look after yourself, you don't drink, stop smoking, exercise regularly, eat healthy, you can have between 5 to 7 years from the time of infection. And I remember thinking, well, that was last year I took that, so I've got between 4 and 6 years if I do all of that. And then I thought, and if I don't look after myself, he says, I can't see you lasting 2 years. And I remember leaving his office thinking, I'd rather have 2 years on my own terms than do all this to try and be healthy and then die in 4 or 5 years. So that's what I did. I went straight then from the hospital. I was in Hamburg at the time on a job. I went straight down to the Reeperbahn, which is their downtown area. And I bought myself 10 bags of heroin and a bag of needles. And I went back to the digs I was staying in. And I locked myself in there for a week. And I wasn't afraid, but I just thought, I was more like astounded by the whole experience. I was like, I felt, in one way it was interested in me because like something really exciting was happening now that I didn't see coming. Like a I thought, if you'd have told me before the fact, I thought I would have been very disappointed or scared or sad. But they weren't the emotions I had. I remember just thinking, oh my God, this is really like on the edge stuff, which I always liked, but this was just different.
Yeah, like is the whole thing a slow suicide in a way, unconsciously?
Do you mean heroin taking?
The whole heroin thing. So is that why
the
AIDS thing didn't freak you out because you were somehow on this path anyway?
That's a very interesting point and I haven't looked at it directly like that.
Oh, damn, okay.
You touched something off. No, it's very interesting. Maybe it is because you're killing yourself anyway when you take heroin. You're killing your spirit.
Yeah.
So that's as good. And that depends on how important that is to you. And to me, that's very important today. At the time, I may not have realised what I was doing, but maybe my subconscious did. So it was like death. Well, you're killing yourself anyway. So, yeah. It's very interesting. Maybe it is. Yeah.
So were you mentioned there a while ago about trying various treatments and things all the time. Were you trying to get off it all the time in different ways?
All the time, Brendan. I never ceased trying to stop. I would be very motivated to stop when I was full on it. Do you understand?
Yeah.
When I was full on it and strung out to bits, I was like, I have to get off this shit. I have to stop this. I got to just have to quit. I'm going to stop. I'm full of motivation. But the next day, you see, I'll wake up and I won't have it in me and I haven't taken it yet and I'll be sweating and that motivation is nowhere near right now. It's gone out the window.
Okay.
Right now I just feel sick and I need to be sorted.
Is that the pattern with people? Do most people
absolutely
want to get off it all
Everyone
the time?
Wants to get off it when they're on it.
Right.
When they're on it and affected by it, they go, I got to stop this, man. I hate this life. I need to stop. Take it away from them the next morning. They don't even want to talk about that. They just want to get sorted. And this is the thinking changes.
Yeah.
You can be so motivated and so committed to wanting to stop. But you take away your substitute, your methadone or the heroin itself and allow the withdrawals and their to come back in.
And the primal need kicks in again then, basically.
And none of that matters. Yeah. These 12-hour talks you had with your father and the priest and all the concerned people around you who love you, it's all out the window. There's only one thing, I got to get sorted.
So how did you get off it eventually?
Well, as I said, I would get off it many times, but I could never stay off it.
Okay.
I knew I had to break the obsession. And I did a lot of research over the years. I mean, I've been to monasteries in Thailand, taking special medicines, all that kind of stuff. I've been in France, in treatment centres, in the Patriarch, which is a whole story in itself. And I've been to everywhere in Ireland, and some of them multiple times. So I knew that I needed to attack the obsession in myself. And I had come across ayahuasca, a visionary plant from South America that had some properties in it that really helped people break habitual thinking patterns. And I figured that, and then I started looking into, well, has it done anything for anybody with addiction? And I found a whole load of stuff on that then. And I started doing a deep dive into this visionary medicine called ayahuasca from South America. And then I managed to locate it in Ireland.
Okay, and just to say, I think it is illegal here. We're not recommending anyone try it.
I wouldn't recommend anybody do it.
Yeah, good man.
It dragged me through hell backwards. And you see, I don't have the answer for how people get off, Brendan. I can only tell you
how I did it. Yeah, but I suppose the first instance, people go to their GP or go to a counsellor and go through that.
This is not an advised way to do it.
Okay, this is your story.
This is just what happened with me. And I was very lucky to come out the other side of it. I mean, I have to say as well, because we talked about the HIV, that was one of the greatest gifts I ever got in life, in a funny kind of way. I didn't see it that way at the time, but it was that started a spiritual quest in me, a search for something with truth in it, whatever that meant. And right through my addiction, though, the only thing I read ever were books on spirituality, because I was just looking for a common thread of truth in all these different traditions. Because I wanted to have some sense of some idea, even if I couldn't have a sense of it. I wanted some idea about truth, something I could hold on to, because I felt if I was going to expire young, I wanted to know something about what does it all mean.
And you think you saw the meaning of life with the ayahuasca?
I think, well, that's a huge statement to make.
Yeah.
But I would certainly say I certainly had, not just with ayahuasca, but the whole spiritual search. And ayahuasca might be like they brought it all together, that moment, the clarity. And I would have just seen a glimpse of what was possible. And I saw a glimpse of the destruction I did to myself and those who loved me in a very clear but benevolent kind of way.
Okay.
And it had a huge effect on me. And I came out of a ceremony after being turned inside out on it. I came out of that ceremony. What people might recall, oh, that was a bad ceremony. I went to a horror ceremony. But it was actually a wonderful ceremony because I was confronted with my own truth on this visionary medicine. I saw the destruction I did. I saw the helplessness of my family as they tried to help me and the hurt I caused. It had a profound effect on me.
Wow.
But I came out with a feeling I never want to use that stuff again. And I haven't used since my ayahuasca experience.
I saw a video you made. You've been in Goa. You're writing a book, I know, the Heroin Chronicles.
Yes.
I saw a video you made in Goa last week. I think it was about a week ago that you had started writing the book. And you've become... it's hit you hard, I think, the realisation of what you did to your parents.
Huge.
Particularly.
Yeah. Yes, I went out there to write the book. I gave myself 10 weeks thinking I should easily do that. If I do a chapter and a half a week, I'll be good. And I went out and what actually happened was it was like a therapy. It was more intense than any of the therapies I've ever done because I'm recalling incidences to write my story in a chronological order of things I did. And it just seems to be just a collection of war stories, which I'm trying to avoid. But what it did was it made me really look at my behaviour in a very profound way. And I got very emotional when I was writing about my father and about his... I got a great sense of him as well. And I had to put the writing away for 3 or 4 days. It was...
You must have broken his heart. Like, you must have destroyed your mother and father's lives, did you?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure I did. And a beautiful gentleman, my father was.
Yeah.
Really a wonderful... wonderful man. And but I pose a question in the book as well. And also something a very dear friend of me said, the relationship doesn't end in death because my father feels very close to me today and was a man that always told me I should write anyway.
Yeah.
I certainly will be dedicating the book to him.
Yeah, God, I hope you can feel that you made good with him because I imagine that'll be very
important.
I do,
Brendan.
Listen, I'm just going to say again, just for absolute clarity, you're not recommending anyone try ayahuasca.
I would recommend they don't.
And we're not suggesting anyone at home do it. Okay. Now, knowing everything you know now, can I ask you, what would you say to people or do to people or young people who maybe don't have I think it's easy for someone like me to think, why would anyone take heroin?
Yeah.
People who don't have a lot else in their lives, I'd imagine it's much easier to think, you know what, this is something anyway.
Sure.
What would you say, or what would you do
to
stop them from going down that road?
Yeah, I don't know if we can stop them. I think they would be, the best we can do is to arm them with the information of what it's actually about and what's actually going on when they take these drugs. And I suppose not to discriminate and put all drugs into the one basket, because it's very important that people realise that opiates are spiritual soul killers. They're a powerful pain medicine, but they will stop emotional pain as well, which is your ability to feel. And you can't feel joy on heroin no more than you can feel real deep sadness or sorrow. So I would, education definitely. I think we, especially in schools, I think kids should be educated to actually what this does. It actually kills your soul.
Yeah. So in a, perhaps a more philosophical discussion around it.
I think so.
And to also maybe help people with that want, that lack, everything. It's amazing how much of it in that documentary, kind of abuse, industrial schools, all that kept coming up as well, that there are a lot of people had that lack through various traumas and that this was the only cure on hand to them. Listen, you have a YouTube channel, Paul. It's Cold Turkey with a K.
That's right.
Which I think is how you came to the attention of the Dublin Narcos production team. But I was looking at some of the videos. They're very, very powerful, short little conversations with various homeless people on the streets in Dublin, just them telling you in a very matter-of-fact way about their lives.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk to me a bit about why you do that.
Well, I did that because I was only about 18 months clean at the time. The pandemic came. And it was more to pursue an interest and have something to do in these times. And the only people I could see, I live in the city centre, were homeless people, because everybody else was off the streets during the initial COVID times. And the homeless people really stood out. And then tents starting to pop up in Grafton Street, outside the Gaiety, all around my neighbourhood. So I decided to interview these people and give them a voice. And I didn't know if they would talk to me or how accessible it would be, but they're my people. I've lived that life. And it's actually, they appreciate that somebody wants to interview them and that there was a bit of interest, or that they get a voice, they got a platform to say something. And it was something I did out of interest, and I kind of approached them with greater sense of empathy. I know what they're going through. I know they're locked in.
You were able to talk to them in a certain way. Yeah.
And I think they're comfortable with that. They know I'm one of them, and I don't get, say, a journalist answer. I get just like I'm talking to someone in the clinic, because some of them I know from just seeing around. Other ones, they're a lot younger, I wouldn't know them, but I know what they're going through.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would recommend anyone have a look at some of those videos. Cold Turkey, K-O-L-D. They're a real education. Brendan Conroy texts to say, Brendan, for young people, mortality is often a very distant, almost unreal horizon. Young people don't understand how hard it will be to stop. They think they're superhuman, but none of us know how easily we will be able to stop a pleasurable practice once we start, even if we know it is damaging us and probably others. And look, Paul, lots of other texts saying that this a very powerful conversation. And someone else says, we're all vulnerable to addiction. Paul is lucky to have survived. And you know what? I think that's one thing that we should all remember, that it's only a hair's breadth between you, me, between the guy on the street in a sleeping bag still on heroin. It's just a bit of luck and a bit of sliding doors going one way or another at another stage, isn't it?
Yeah, a few wrong choices early on can change the whole blueprint, yeah.
Okay, listen, Dublin Narcos is available on Sky Documentaries and Now TV. And Paul, good luck with the writing of the Heroin Chronicles. And Paul Tracy, thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Brendan. Thank you very much.
Email brendan@rte.ie.